Joining us now is Erica Chenoweth, who is a professor of government at Wesleyan University and director of Wesleyan's program on terrorism and insurgency research. Previously, she was a fellow at the International Security Program at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her books include Rethinking Violence, States and Non-State Actors in Conflict, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, and the forthcoming Why Democracy Encourages Terrorism. She has an article on foreign policy called Think Again, Nonviolent Resistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erica Chenoweth.
Thank you.
And given that violence was used in removing Gaddafi, not that he's entirely out of the picture, how does the case apply to Libya when it seems so obvious that the case that you've made in your foreign policy article applies to Syria?
Yeah, so one of the things I want to make clear is that all of the claims I'm making are probabilistic, meaning that not only are they based on probabilities, based on all of the analysis from 1900 to 2006 of previous cases, but they also are highly contingent on local conditions. The argument I'm making is that nonviolent resistance tends to be a superior strategic choice when used against brutal regimes for a host of reasons. But we also recognize in our book particularly that 25% of violent campaigns have also succeeded. So just because you use violence doesn't mean that you're going to fail. It just means that you're about half as likely to succeed as if you rely solely on nonviolent resistance. In fact, I think the Syrian case proves this point somewhat because despite the fact that Assad has been brutally repressing people and estimates are that over 2,000 people, civilians, have died in that conflict so far, the nonviolent movement persists, and you can see that there are widespread condemnations, even from other brutal dictators, against Assad's behavior. Whereas many of them showed more support for Gaddafi as soon as that rebellion turned violent.
But, Erica, one of the things apparently that's keeping Assad in power is the help he's getting from Iran, not just about $6 to $7 billion in credits, but also the Al-Quds force apparently is there, according to analysis from the Europeans. The Quds are there helping him, and, you know, they got practice cracking down on the Green Movement in Iran. So would that suggest that you have, that the Iranians are, in effect, exporting the opposite argument to yours, which is the ability to break nonviolent resistant movements?
Yeah, so I think that in our study we actually used the support of a regime by an outside regime as one of the variables that might explain whether a regime can sustain this type of movement. And what we found is that external support from an important ally is not that important in explaining whether a grassroots movement succeeds or fails. It can certainly complicate the case, and I think you're right that if Iran hadn't continued to support Syria, we would have seen Assad fall much more quickly. But I also want to make a very strong point that it doesn't necessarily preclude the success of the movement, because the movement will succeed by eroding the regime's power from within. And they do that all the time by basically expanding their membership and by removing the regime from its key sources of power. In this case, the security forces, economic elites, and civilian bureaucrats that are keeping that regime moving on a day-to-day basis. Those are the people whose non-cooperation will ultimately bring down the regime. And it's very difficult to convince them to stop cooperating with the regime when they feel violently threatened by armed insurgents.
Again, I'm speaking with Erica Chenoweth, co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. And I've spoken in the past at length with Gene Sharp, and as you know, some of his works have been employed by Otpor in Serbia and by the Arab Spring revolutions in Tunisia and in Egypt, even though he himself does not claim to be in any way, he doesn't feel in any way he can take credit for any of this. So what credit would you give Gene Sharp?
Well, I think he is a little modest when he says he can't take any credit. On the other hand, I know that there are many people in Egypt and Tunisia who say that even though they saw Gene Sharp's materials circulating in Tahrir Square and elsewhere, that it was their revolution and that, you know, they could have done it without Gene Sharp, too. I think we need to empirically study that question. We need to talk to movement activists and find out exactly to what extent they were actively training and preparing using his materials. I can say that that particularly Egypt had a bit of a Gene Sharp flavor to it, insofar as the movement, those that were kind of prepared and organizing the movement were following the suggestions that he lays out in his book, Politics of Nonviolent Action. They were mixing their tactics. They were extremely well prepared for repression and had multiple plan Bs and plan Cs and plan Ds for how to deal with it when it happened. They weren't over-reliant on any particular tactics that made them very vulnerable to regime repression, and they well played the critical element of getting the army to not cooperate with the regime, and I think that was the key for them.
So just to go back to the current example of Libya, and clearly there does seem to be something universal about these revolutions in the Arab Spring, and that is the aspirations, particularly of the young. The word dignity comes up a lot, the idea that they feel that the elites have stolen their futures and they want to restore their own personal dignity. In the case of course, in Syria, the bravery on the part of the people who take to the streets every day facing tanks and artillery is something that I don't think we could we certainly, you know, over here, maybe if a few people have their heads cracked by police and maybe get pepper sprayed or tear gas. But this is a whole other level of nonviolence, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think that's right. And one thing that's very interesting is that you see the youth, especially in Egypt and Tunisia, starting to express discouragement about their role in the transition. But this is also a continuity from other previous nonviolent uprisings. Take Serbia as an example. The Otpor movement had a somewhat controversial role in the ouster of Slobodan Milosevic in 2000. A lot of people say that they've overstated the extent to which they affected that movement and so forth, but ultimately they did have an important role in that. But then they tried to form a political party and run for parliament, and they thought that because of the important role they played in the Serbian revolution, that they would be rewarded at the polls. And actually what happened is they got hardly any of the vote at all. And the feedback they got from the Serbian people was, we want you to throw out our dictators, but we don't want you to rule us. And so I think a lot of the youth feel discouraged when they recognize that that's the sentiment. Yet it's also very predictable based on past.
But the one thing that's different about the Arab Spring revolutions, I guess, is the degree to which the dictators are prepared to be ruthless. And clearly Mubarak folded under international pressure, even though the Saudi king every day was calling up Obama and screaming at him, saying, let Mubarak shoot those kids in Tahrir Square. Assad, we've seen what he's done. The Saudis essentially trying to bribe their youth and give them money so that they won't be disaffected, which of course they are. But just to take the Libyan example of the day, what do you think would have happened had the protest stayed nonviolent at the very moment when NATO intervened, where the president intervened on the basis of what he thought would be a humanitarian catastrophe in Benghazi, where Gaddafi had already said that he would crush these people like insects?
Yeah, I think that I'd say two things about it. First of all, I think that there wouldn't necessarily have been more bloodshed than there was with the NATO intervention, the bombings and the campaigns against Gaddafi's remaining army. I think that, you know, there may have been people that sort of put themselves in a position using nonviolent action to be repressed, but there are a host of nonviolent actions available to these campaigns that don't put them at high risk for repression, like strikes, boycotts, stay-at-homes, things like this that are actually fairly disruptive, particularly to the economy, but don't put people in harm's way. That's not to say that Gaddafi wouldn't have tried to go house to house, pull people out of their homes and make them go back to work or terrorize them in horrible ways, which we know he was capable of doing. But that's just to say that people wouldn't necessarily have to have been in harm's way. We do have reports that casualty rates have been around 13,000, for instance, in this months-long conflict, whereas in Syria, which has gone on longer, only 2,000 people are dead under Assad's brutality. The second point I would make is that at least some reports by people like Juan Cole and also an op-ed writer in the New York Times today indicate that there was actually mass civil resistance going on in Tripoli before the rebels even got there. Apparently, hundreds of thousands of people hit the streets and, what Juan Cole says, essentially cast off the regime. It suggests that civil resistance may have actually had more of a part to play in the Libyan endgame than most analysts are recognizing at this moment.
Again, I'm speaking with Erica Chenoweth, co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. One of the things, though, that you learn about these much-feared dictators when they finally are brought down is the kind of delusional and pathetic nature of them. I mean, the sort of, little Napoleonic martinets dressed up with all of their... I mean, I saw one of the Berbers sacking Gaddafi's palace wearing his military hat with all of the scrambled egg and gold chains and stuff. And, you know, Mubarak is now a pathetic figure. Is there any way that you can expose that the emperor has no clothes before the downfall?
Yeah, and I think that's a brilliant strategy, and movements should exploit that because, there are a lot of quirks about people. For instance, Imelda Marcos, she's infamous for her shoes and how much she loves shoes and that she just accumulated all of this wealth and spent it on things. And Filipinos definitely mocked that during the uprising. With Ben Ali in Tunisia, there was similar mocking that was happening against his wife and family, who were the source of a lot of grievance because of their perceived corruption. And humor plays a huge role in many of these uprisings. For instance, the Polisario Front in Morocco's in Western Sahara is illegal. It's illegal to show the secessionist flag. So one of the things that these movements did was the nonviolent movement, that is, they actually gathered up a lot of stray cats in Morocco and tied these flags onto their tails and then set them loose in this public square. And the desired effect is exactly what they got, which was that all of the security forces were chasing these cats around the public square, making it look like they were trying to herd cats. And, people laughed. And that's exactly the effect that these movements want to have, which is to unify people behind a common set of knowledge that people share but don't usually say out loud because they're afraid of retaliation.
And how much do you think, Erica Chenoweth, that's operating in Syria? Because I know there's a popular anthem there, Bashar Leave, and I believe they've changed the tune a little bit now, saying something to the effect that, well, now that Gaddafi's gone, it's your turn next. How much did I've also seen some very effective rap songs from Syria. So give us a sense of how that's working.
Well, I think the primary function that this sort of activity has is that it helps people to overcome their fear. I've heard from a number of activists that something that really helps them when they're standing on the front lines and essentially facing down automatic gunfire from these leaders is that they sing, and they have comedy skits that they put on together just to lighten the atmosphere a little bit and make people less afraid and feel like they're more a part of a whole. And for some reason, that's helpful to people. And I think humor and music and rap and slogans like this serve a similar purpose. They're much more powerful than just words. They're serving a psychological or a cognitive function. Doug McAdam calls it cognitive liberation, just the idea where suddenly you realize that you can do things you couldn't do before because you're in a group. And so I think that the slogans really help with that.
And do you see any likelihood, that we'll be seeing any of these activities on our streets? Not that we have dictatorships by comparison, but Recently, I'm sure you saw what happened in the streets of London. Most of that was criminality, organized, by the way, by social media. But there were elements of political protest in terms of class protest. What's your sense of protest in this country, much of which, I guess, comes from the left, except for the Tea Party. But they've been so successful politically. Do you see anything on the horizon?
Well, I actually see things happening all the time. I'm in the Bay Area at the moment, and so there are BART protests going on because of a shooting of a man and the Civic Center BART over the 4th of July weekend by BART police. And, of course, the big scuttlebutt about that is that the BART police have shut down cell phone service so that people couldn't coordinate more protests and disrupt the service. And so, they're accusing BART police of behaving just like the Arab dictators with shutting down social media. I don't know about that, but basically I see protests happening in the United States nonstop. The main difference here is that the grievances that people usually have, whether they're on the left, the right, or in the middle, are not as widely shared, typically, as the grievances that people in the Middle East and North Africa have at the moment. Even if people are critical of President Obama, for instance, most people are not willing to give up a week's worth of pay or even their jobs or their livelihoods to go out in the streets until he's gone. And one of the things that we know about these nonviolent movements particularly is that they require great numbers of people participating in order to succeed. And the reason is because ultimately it's the people who have the connections with these different pillars of support that are enabling them to leverage over the regime. And so, most people, I have friends who work in the United States civilian bureaucracy, and I'm not calling them and asking them to wield any particular influence or stay home from work because I, have particular grievances about the way the government is operating. And I doubt many people in this country are. So they don't really achieve the level of disruption necessary to affect change. And they don't share the popular, legitimate grievances that are necessary to get a huge, sustained movement behind them.
Well, that's not to say, though, that occasionally the protests can be cleverly tailored. For example, I spoke yesterday with Bill McKibben, who was arrested over the weekend for protesting in front of the White House, and he's an environmentalist who's organized a serial of people showing up there, and it's a 2-week long protest,
right?
That as they arrest them, more will come, and that's meant to focus the president on the choice that he has to make whether or not to allow the tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to cross the United States through a pipeline to refineries in Texas. I would say that that's a pretty clever strategy. Seems to, at least it got my attention,
Yes, that's right. And most of these movements, if they're well-planned, well-coordinated, unified behind a common message that has real resonance with people, and it's really hard to argue with their legitimate grievances, and they can find a way to sort of undermine the interests of the incumbent to maintain the status quo, they can affect change, no doubt about it. And I think that in this country, that's usually the type of change we're going to be looking at. It isn't this sort of regime change where you're casting off an entire government system or a leader, but it's policy changes. And we've actually seen a lot of different effective social movements in this country related to that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Erica Chenoweth. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Erica Chenoweth, who's a professor of government at Wesleyan University and director of Wesleyan's Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research. Previously, she was a fellow at the International Security Program at the Belfer Center at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Her books include Rethinking Violence, States and Non-State Actors in Conflict, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of a Nonviolent Conflict, and the forthcoming Why Democracy Encourages Terrorism. She has an article at Foreign Policy called Think Again, Nonviolent Resistance. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.